Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we speak with a first-time novelist of a very entertaining book. Robin Sloan is a man versed in new technology. He worked at Twitter and developed the system that put tweets on screen, first at Current Television and now it's used throughout cable television. With that background, it makes sense that his first novel would create a plot line on the tension between OT, as one character in his book describes it, old technology, and new. Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore has been called an adventure story for the digital age. In it, Clay Janin is a San Francisco web designer who loses his job during the Great Recession. And through curiosity and the ability to climb a ladder like a monkey, he's landed a new job working the night shift at Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore in San Francisco. But after a few days on the job, Clay begins to realize that this store is even more curious than the name suggests. There are only a few customers. They come in repeatedly, and they never actually seem to buy anything. Instead, they check out very obscure old volumes from strange corners of the store, all according to an elaborate, long-standing arrangement with the gnomic Mr. Penumbra. The store must be a front for something larger. So soon, Clay has embarked on an analysis of the customer's behavior and ropes his friends, who all work in the high-tech world, into helping him figure out what's going on. And when they finally discuss their findings with Mr. Penumbra, turns out the secrets extend far outside the walls of the bookstore. The book is a page-turner for those who love musty bookstores and old books, as well as those who revel at the effects of new technology on our society. The name of the book is Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and Robin Sloan is my guest. Robin Sloan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks.
As I understand it, the origins of this book came from, you were, I guess, walking out and around and you saw a sign that said 24-hour book drop and you thought you saw 24-hour bookstore. Was that the origins of this piece?
It wasn't me that saw the sign. It was a friend of mine from, you know, across the country. And she saw the sign and made the mistake. And then she tweeted it. She actually wrote that in a tweet. She said, you know, just saw a sign for 24-hour book drop, thought it said 24-hour bookshop. My disappointment is beyond words. and I saw that on my phone. I was walking down the street in San Francisco, and it made me smile, and I wrote it down. And then a couple months later, when I sat down to start a new short story, there it was waiting for me.
And in fact, Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore was actually a short story first. What point did you realize you had a novel on your hands?
You know, I would say it was a few months after I had first published it. And keep in mind, this was self-published. I released it in the Kindle store. I posted it on my website for people to read for free. And it just kind of gathered an audience, or I should say it found an audience almost immediately. I just realized that something about the combination of the old and the new, books and, you know, mysterious bookstores and technology was really speaking to people in a way that I didn't necessarily anticipate. But once it was out there, I just realized there was more to do kind of at that intersection.
And one of the interesting things about this book is while it is basically an adventure novel in many ways, I mean, it has elements of fantasy. It has your characters are old Dungeons and Dragons players. And there's that sort of adventurous sense to this novel. It gets into some really serious issues for serious readers, which is this whole battle between technology and the old technology, or old knowledge, as you put it in the book, holding a book versus holding a Kindle.
Yeah, that's right. And I would say one of the things I tried to do was frame it not only as a battle or a struggle, but a synthesis. You know, there's plenty of characters in the book who love both things. They're kind of positioned in the borderland between those worlds, and they're trying to negotiate between them. There's people in the book who are into book scanning. They really want to kind of bring books into the digital world. But of course, to scan a book, you really have to understand it. You have to understand its physical characteristics. You have to build a machine, some sort of contraption that can kind of make sense of a physical book. And I like that. You know, I like people who rather than picking sides, decide that they're going to work with everything, physical and digital alike.
you know, I assume you're taking us a little bit inside Google, which is, this is a part of the book. There's also the sort of, they're not computer hackers so much as they're sort of technology hackers that gets involved in the plot. And I kept thinking, I said, okay, now how much of this is his imagination and how much of this is really what's going on? Because I think, you know, for most people, we pull up Google, we put in a term, it finds it. It usually finds exactly what we're looking for. And we don't think a thing about it beyond that. And one of the things you do in the book is you sort of raise the curtain on what's going on at Google and this just crazy company that is, well, it's transformed our society.
Rich, I am so glad to hear that you had that question. You know, is this real? Is this imagined? To me, that is totally success. I love putting things in that borderland between fact and fiction. And the idea that this book is novel is sending people to a Google search box to kind of, you know, ferret things out and figure them out is just the coolest thing. And I think that's fun. It's the truth is, you know, some of these institutions and some of these new technologies, and certainly a place like Google, some of the stuff they do sounds like it ought to be fictional. You know, this is a company that actually has self-driving cars. You kind of go, really? Like, is that possible already? So it's a fun place to play. And I have to say, I really had a ball kind of embroidering things right at that boundary. The Google in the book is not the real Google. You know, this is not a documentary rendering of the company. I'd say it's an affectionate exaggeration.
Well, let's get into the world of Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore. At the beginning of the book, we're meeting Clay Janin, who he's got out into the marketing world. He's designing websites. He's, you know, in San Francisco, you know, the hub of this sort of work. And, of course, he gets caught up by the Great Recession. So he's looking for a job, and he stumbles upon this 24-hour bookstore. And it's the most unusual bookstore he's ever been in, because first of all, nobody goes in. There's very few books, although there are some books he loves, but there are very few books for sale, so to speak. Describe Mr. Penumbra's bookstore.
Well, of course, it also has some strange physical characteristics, right? It's very tall and skinny, and the shelves in the back seem to go up and up and up until they disappear into the shadows. And, you know, this was a fun process because, again, you know, imagine me sitting down to write the initial short story, and I'm starting from this tweet, really just a scrap, you know, the idea of a 24-hour bookshop. And I just kind of imagined it piece by piece. And then, you know, suddenly this proprietor emerged from the shelves, and it was this old man with bright blue eyes named Mr. Penumbra. And then, of course, after I'd put the bookstore together, and of course, I didn't quite know what all the pieces meant yet. I didn't know what the puzzles, you know, waiting inside the store were. But I did know what it looked like. I knew how it felt. And then I had to put it down somewhere. I had to kind of give it a location. And it was almost like, you know, Wizard of Oz with the house tumbling down through the sky to go whoomp onto the ground. It sort of fell into San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood. And for people who know the city, it's probably right around the corner from City Lights Books, the legendary bookshop here. And you know, like with neon signs on either side, it's sort of a seedy neighborhood, actually. And yeah, that's where the story begins. That's where Clay wanders and sees a help wanted sign and decides to go check it out.
And after a few days on the job, he's even more thoroughly confused because only the odd occasional customer wanders in. And yet there is these members of the bookstore who have a very specific code, and they borrow books as opposed to buy books in the way back section, which is almost like a vault when you're 3-story ladder to get up to grab these books down. And they all seem very strange. This is a very strange place.
There's a line at some point where, you know, Clay has really realized that this place is strange indeed. You know, it's kind of gone from being eccentric to just truly weird. And there's a line that goes something like, you know, well, what am I going to do? Just sit here quietly at my desk as a vortex of weirdness spirals around me? Well, I realize that describes a lot of jobs, but, you know, dot, dot, dot. Yeah. And I had fun with that notion that... it's more than just the 24-hour bookstore jobs that are full of, strange customers and strange rituals and activities you undertake without quite understanding their impact on the world. And I know from people who have read the book kind of reporting back that they smiled and nodded and said, yeah, you know, I got to say, I don't work in a, secret 24-hour bookshop, but that part was pretty familiar.
Well, and the other thing about the book is that, again, this sort of mixture of exaggeration of facts misplaced that are in there. And I, for example, I know all the techies that have been reading this book, they're struck by your use of numbers, because apparently every number is a prime number in the book.
That's right. I, especially as a reader, I never liked the feeling that any detail was just random. And it's not that it has to be deep with import. Not everything has to be a secret code 10 levels deep. But I never liked the idea of, a character named Jerry just because, oh, yeah, that's what occurred to me. Or, an address, 1955 Pine Street. Ah, yeah, I just made it up. I like the idea that, everything is considered and there's just a little grace note of meaning behind everything. And so, for all the numbers in Penumbra, even if the rationale is as simple as, it's a prime, there's something there. And the same is true for other things, for names, for references, for places. There's actually a lot to discover there for people who enjoy a good close reading of a book.
And I've had so far some interesting discoveries. For example, very early in the book, we learn about a particular font that, it really doesn't exist, but it's Gerrit Svoon.
Mm-hmm.
And this plays a role later in the book. And Gerrit Svoon is actually a combination of what? Two different people. Griffo, the first name, was a font maker for a very early printer who shows up.
That's
later.
Right. He was one of the great font makers. We have the real life Griffo to thank for italics. For this this whole school, this whole style of typography. He was the one who essentially cut those first beautiful swooping letters in Venice back around 1500. Yeah, that's Griffo.
And then Gerrit Svoon is also a real person too.
Yeah, Gerrit Svoon actually was a fairly common name, and it might still be in some parts of the world, but I was using it to refer specifically to Erasmus. Before Erasmus chose a fancy Latin name, because of course if you were a serious writer in that time, you had to choose a fancy Latin name. His real name, his given name, his family name was Gerrit Svoon. And I wanted to give a call out to Erasmus because he was, as far as we know, the first person in the era of printing to actually make a living as an author. For a long time after printing was developed and perfected in Europe, you couldn't actually write new work. All the printers were totally occupied printing Bibles and, the classics. They had a backlog of great stuff to print. And so if you showed up at the printing house with a new manuscript, they'd say, we're fine. We got Sophocles, we got Aristotle. You should come back in 50 years. And so Erasmus was kind of born at the right time and kind of, found a way to just kind of slip in as the classics were finally being extinguished and they were looking for something new to print. I feel like professional writers should all kind of take him as their patron saint because he was the first one to make a living from writing and then having his writing published.
My guest today is Robin Sloan. He worked for Twitter for a while. He worked for Current TV. He's the man who put the first tweets up on television screens, worked in the technology field for a while. He's now become a writer, and his first novel is getting great reviews, and it is a page-turner. If you love books and you also love technology and you sort of worry about whether technology is going to supplant books, well, this book is right up your alley. It's called Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, a Novel, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, getting back to the story, Clay Janin is working in this bookshop. Mr. Penumbra is he seems like a very nice boss, but he has three rules, and the last one is whatever you do, back in the Wayback Library, you don't open any of the books.
That's right.
And, of course, Clay does because, you're working overnight, you're bored. And actually, a friend actually sort of challenges him to look in the book. And it is a beautiful typeset, but it's pretty much gibberish for the most part.
And there's something there about, you know, I actually tried to have fun with that idea, too. The idea, like, what makes a book great? Is it how it looks, you know, its design, its construction, or is it its readability? You know, is it its accessibility? And there's a part where Clay, later in the book, after he's, you know, spent some time with these crazy coded books, gets really frustrated, and he says, you know, these books suck. They're like fortresses, you know, walled fortresses that expect you to climb stone by stone. And my favorite books, he says, are the ones that are like open cities with all sorts of different ways to wander in.
Yeah, no, that's a great line. That's a great line. And there's great lines throughout this. I know a lot of tech friends are talking about there was a great line that was in the short story, and they were hoping it would move to the novel, and it does. It's she seemed like the girl who would be impressed by a prototype.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Clay's love interest, the genius from Google, who he decides to try to woo with a bit of coding, even though he's not a very good programmer himself. I definitely tried to put into this book some characters or archetypes, I should say, that are fairly common, you know, here in the San Francisco Bay Area these days, but not very well represented in fiction, I don't think, at least not yet. And one of them is the girl who you can impress with a prototype, the designer programmer, this kind of just, you know, Renaissance person genius that you find working at places like Google these days.
And the whole ethos of Google is pretty interesting. You know, for us here in the middle of the country, we don't really, you know, this all-consuming job, and it's all about what can I do new today that would change the world? I mean, that seems to be the attitude of that character. Is that a common theme among these tech people that are working for companies like Google?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a couple pieces there that you mentioned that are both right. One is the notion that, you know, these jobs, these organizations, that they really do sort of embrace and surround your whole life. And that's by design. You know, you go to work on the Google campus or the Facebook campus, and there's great food there, and it's all free, and there's other amenities. You know, there's everything from, you know, gyms to pool tables to video games. Often there's, you know, increasingly things like childcare, healthcare. And so why would you leave? This kind of really becomes your world. And in some cases, it's sort of a hermetically sealed world. So that's one piece. And then the other piece is that notion that you're going there not to relax. You know, you're not going to kick back your heels and say, man, this is a sweet gig I ended up with. No, they're deeply ambitious places, and people are really pushing each other to think big. You know, the people who work at these places, they're used to operating on a huge scale. It's lots of data. When they make changes, it influences lots of different people. So when people go to work in these wonderful campuses, they're always sort of challenging each other to think bigger and, you know, think of projects that could operate at an even bigger scale.
One of the things, it almost sounds like it's almost like your old Cold War skunk works in many senses. You know, I mean, they're about, you know, things that may never work in the real world, but they're going to make them anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that's exactly right. And that makes it fun, I think, to speculate. There's so much happening at any one of these companies that, you know, we don't know about and we may never know about. And anytime you find a sort of shadowy region like that, we have just a few little pinpricks of knowledge, but the rest is all in darkness. I think that's the perfect place for fiction to work. It's the perfect place for the imagination to go to work.
Well, Google plays a role because, as we all know, that Google is basically copying all the books, you know, of the world that have ever been written, and putting them into digital form. And this plays a role because the central core, without giving away too much about the book, is there is this mystery, and there are these people trying to figure out this mystery, and it all surrounds a Renaissance printer. We all know Gutenberg, but we don't know, was it Minutius?
I say it Minutius.
Minutius. this is at the heart of the novel, and this is at the heart of the mystery, so I don't want to give too much away, but what can you tell us about Aldus Manutius?
Oh, man. You know, Aldus Manutius was one of history's all-time cool guys. I knew a little bit about him before the book, and as he kind of worked his way into the story, I read a lot more. And I came away so impressed, not only with him, but with kind of everyone who was working, especially in Venice and in some of those other city-states around that time, around 1500, right there at the dawn of the printing business. And the reason I was so impressed is that reading about them, reading about the arguments they had, reading about the crazy competition of the time, and just reading about the energy with which they were cranking out these beautiful books, it sounded familiar. It actually didn't sound old-fashioned or musty or medieval at all. It sounded a lot like Silicon Valley today. Just the way that they thought about what they were doing, and frankly, the way that they competed with one another was actually very modern and very familiar. And so I wanted to put some of that spirit into it. You know, these were not monks in their monastery kind of quietly and politely toiling away on these classics. These were businessmen. These were entrepreneurs, and they were involved in what was honestly the internet of its day.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point about this whole book is you're getting into the mindset of 600 years ago, they were doing the same thing. There was this huge wave that was changing, and they probably were aware of that. And it was just like we have, digital converts, Luddites, and digital natives today, you know, digital natives who understand it, us people who have converted who sort of halfway understand it, and then people who don't even try to understand it. The world was the same way probably in 1500 with
the
printing press.
Absolutely. You know, reading about Manutius and his printing house, and actually I got the chance to see a few of the books that they printed. You know, there are many that are still out there, you know, in museums and libraries and other places. And I got the chance to see a few, and I saw one. It was a smaller one. It was actually one of the first pocket-sized books ever produced in history. And looking at it, you can just see this was the iPhone of its day. You can imagine some Venetian businessman kind of coming into the printing house and looking at this thing and feeling that same sort of lust, you know, that an early adopter feels for whatever the coolest new gadget is in 2012.
And I guess he printed all the classics. You know, Gutenberg was printing Bibles and things like that. He was going back and doing the Greeks and the early Romans.
Yeah, that's right. That was really Manutius' contribution. He was the first person to do the classics. Everybody from Aristotle to Virgil and Ovid and Homer, he was the first person to print those. And so if you were somebody who was interested in, you know, the old Greek poets or in the Odyssey or the Iliad, the place you could get them, you know, not in a totally crazy, illuminated, handwritten, you know, inscribed edition. The first place you could get them ever in history was from Aldus Manutius in Venice.
My guest today is Robin Sloan. His first novel is out, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. If you love books, if you love the history books, if you're into technology, you're going to love this book. And if you like sort of literary adventures, this really reads like a little like Harry Potter, a little like a Dungeons and Dragons story, as along with all these literary references from years ago. And you've really done a masterful job of just creating a page-turning, I don't want to say it's a mystery, because we think of a mystery as, well, it is a mystery, but it's not your mystery genre. It's more subtle, I think.
Yeah, you know, people, you've used the word adventure a few times, and other people have used the word adventure too. And I do think it's more of an adventure or even a quest. It certainly has elements of the mysterious. You know, as you've mentioned, there is this central mystery at the core. But in terms of the structure of the story, and I think the things that people have been responding to, at least so far, it's that adventure. It's a group of friends, you know, who have sort of set off on a quest, and who knows where it's going to take them.
Now, is that the sort of writing you like to read yourself? That sort of the idea of the quest, the fantasy sort of structure?
It is. You know, my reading tastes are varied, and I like all sorts of things. But I will admit, you know, a good quest, especially the classic quest where you've got a, you know, unexpected hero, you know, in a small town or just far from the action, far from the drama, somehow gets started on this crazy adventure and then picks up allies along the way. I've always loved stories like that, and I think I always will.
Now, there's another little, I assume you actually sort of gave hints to your own reading choices, because at the front of Mr. Penumbra's store is a few books that are for sale, and it's things like Dashiell Hammett, and I assume you had got to have a lot of fun sort of putting your favorites in there.
Oh, yeah. You know, in some ways, I think every novel ought to feature a fictional bookstore, even if it's just a throwaway in some scene or some chapter, because what better way to give direct homage to the books and authors that you love the most? That was fun to go through and sort of stock the fictional Mr. Penumbra's shelves with all my favorites, you know, exactly. Great San Francisco stories, old science fiction, the books I loved from my youth. That was great.
I want to ask you one last question. You've come from the tech side, and you're now writing a physical book as well as a Kindle version of this book. And I think a lot of people who love books, they worry about the future of books in a digital world. What would you say to those folks who worry about the, you know, that that's at least a small point in the whole plot line? This whole mix of technology changing things about the literary world.
You know, I think it connects exactly back to some of the other things that we've been talking about, and especially somebody like Aldus Manutius. You read about Aldus Manutius and his peers 500 years ago, and you realize that what they were doing was deeply high tech. I mean, again, I'll repeat it just because it bears repeating. It was the internet of its age. And the truth is, it's continued to be high tech. It's not like we invented books and then they were done and they've stood still ever since. No way. We've always been refining the techniques of printing and of distribution. And we've been changing the way we think about what makes a book and what counts as a book. So I think the truth is that, you know, for the first part, books are technology and they always have been. And therefore, technology is not some strange new visitor to the bookstore. It's always been there. It's been there from the very beginning. And I think when you realize that, it does calm your nerves a little, because you realize this is a medium and it's a community that's been grappling with change for a very long time. So I'm not worried about these you know, new changes of the early 21st century. Books and sort of the culture of books have navigated things just as strange and just as new for a long time.
All right. Name of the book is Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, a novel. Robin Sloan, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Robin Sloan is the author of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, a novel. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed some of our previous episodes, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.